Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Session 3 on your program, entitled The Oath of Vengeance. We have people still checking in, I understand. Is a line shortened out there, or... Are there still people wandering in? Anyway, we'll go ahead and start. We have a fairly full program today. I'm Ross Anderson. I'll be chairing the session. Each of you should have a tag, and if you don't, you probably didn't get in the session. But we're happy to have you. When I was asked to chair this, the word Oath of Vengeance rang a bell with me. When I was a missionary in the Central States Mission, we were working with missionaries in Arkansas. And we were working with a pair who said, gee, we're having a hard time getting anyone to talk to us in these towns. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, come with us. We will show you. And so we went into a small town. I can't remember the name of the town. I think it was Conway. And in the center of the town square was a monument that looked like a small Washington monument, about 25 feet tall. And on that monument it said, from this town, in the summer of 1857, left a party who were massacred by the Mormons in Mountain Meadow. And so, naturally, our missionary work wasn't too good. And then, quoted under that was, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. That has nothing to do with the program, but I thought it was interesting folklore. Our main presenter today will be Van Hale. Van is a noted talk show religious host on KZZI AM, which is 1510 on your dial. I understand that he is a defender of the faith. He does an excellent job. He attended BYU. He's married and has 5 children. The comment on his paper will be delivered by Jeffrey Hardiman. Jeffrey is an engineer with U.S. West in California, where he engineers telecommunication systems. He attended ASU University, and he also has a wife and 5 children. He also collects rare books, kind of as an amateur. He said he's not in Mark Hoffman's league at all. So with that introduction, we will hear first from Van Hale.
I actually have a little bit more material than I should have prepared for this presentation. I thought we were going to have a little bit more time. And so rather than try and cut some material, I think what I will do is try and talk faster than I am usually accustomed to doing. So I'm going to try and move quickly through this. Hopefully you all have a little handout, and that will help as I get to a certain portion. I'm going to abbreviate some of my comments by having you at your leisure look at this handout. In 1980, Ed Decker, a zealous ex-Mormon, began circulating an open letter to the President, First Presidency, and members of the general authorities of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Copies were sent to President Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. In the letter, Decker asserts that an oath of vengeance against the United States of America was administered in LDS temples at least until 1930, after which it was removed. Decker presents this oath basically as follows. You and each of you do solemnly promise and vow that you will pray and never cease to importune high heaven to avenge the blood of the prophets, Joseph and Hiram, on this nation, and that you will teach this to your children and your children's children unto the third and fourth generation. He points out that a number of the present general authorities are old enough to have received their endowments prior to 1930 and are therefore bound by this oath. And he calls for Mormons who hold office in the government to repent of oaths of obedience to a group of men who are sworn to seek vengeance against this great nation. Since nothing remotely resembling this occurs in current temple ceremonies, and patriotism is so strongly advocated throughout LDS church literature, Latter-day Saints may ask, why would anyone make such a claim? Since Decker joined the LDS Church long after he claims this oath was removed, what is his source? For those reading For those whose reading consists of popular LDS publications, the chance of being exposed to the oath of vengeance is remote. However, it has been a very popular topic in anti-Mormon publications, particularly from the 1850s to the 1930s. Almost every temple exposé during that period, some 50 in number, includes some form of the oath of vengeance. Also, those opposing Utah's several petitions for statehood from 1849 to 1896 argued that Utah should not be admitted because Mormons entered into treasonous oaths in the endowment ceremony. In naturalization hearings in Salt Lake City in 1889, the testimony of a number of ex-Mormons who had experienced the ceremony convinced Judge Thomas J. Anderson of the existence of such an oath. This, in part, led to his decision that, quote, an alien who is a member of the church is not a fit person to be made a citizen of the United States. Further, it was a major point used in the attempt to stop the seating of Apostle Reed Smoot in the U.S. Senate during hearings from 1904 to 1906. I have found testimony of at least 75 individuals over a span of at least 100 years who have declared, most from first-hand experience, that an oath of vengeance against this nation was administered in the endowment ceremony. Recently, a copy of a letter on Salt Lake Temple letterhead has circulated. It is from George F. Richards to the president of the St. George Temple, dated February 15, 1927, and concerns some changes to be made in the temple ceremony as authorized by President Heber J. Grant. One of the instructions was, quote, omit from the prayer in the circles all reference to avenging the blood of the prophets. In light of all this, many may ask, how could anyone doubt that for many years the endowment ceremony included an oath of vengeance against this nation? Although many Mormons, as well as anti-Mormons, accept the existence of the oath of vengeance against this nation as an established fact, I believe there is compelling evidence which argues against this purported oath ever having been a part of the endowment ceremony. I am not aware of any treatment of the subject which has carefully examined the available evidence from both ex-Mormon and Mormon testimony. Almost all discussions of the topic are found in anti-Mormon sources, in which the authors have been persuaded by their biases to ignore any evidence which would undermine their portrayal of Mormonism as anti-American. The most extensive treatment I have seen is that of Gerald and Sandra Tanner in 1972 and 1982 publications. While they present uncritically a number of testimonies to the existence of the oath, they merely acknowledge some inconsistencies and denials, but do so without citing or examining any of them. There is, in fact, much more affirming ex-Mormon testimony than there are Mormon denials. And the denials are usually simple statements to the effect that there is no oath in the endowment to avenge the blood of Joseph and Hiram upon this nation or government, with no comment upon the actual content of the ceremony. However, I do not believe that this issue is one which can properly be decided simply by sorting statements into two piles and accepting the claim for which there is the greatest bulk of testimony. Those who have been, without question, the best possible witnesses, namely those who have been intimately involved in the performance and recording of the ritual, have generally been unwilling to comment. LDS leaders as well as active temple workers past and present have refused to discuss the endowment ceremony. They have even allowed bitter opponents to circulate outrageously twisted and distorted accounts of the ceremony without comment. LDS writers and apologists have generally respected this sensitivity and have avoided discussion on points of controversy involving the temple ceremony, I guess perhaps up until now. There is, however, some significant Mormon rebuttal, and it is persuasive. There also is considerable discrepancy in the ex-Mormon testimony, some of which substantially supports the Mormon denials. First, I would like to, I think I'm missing a page here, I hope not. I've done that once before. First, I will present some of the ex-Mormon testimony. But before looking at the charges and denials, the testimonies and the rebuttal, we need to have several questions in mind. Both Mormons and ex-Mormons agree that the endowment ceremony included something about avenging and something about prophets. I will summarize briefly here the two contrasting claims. First, some ex-Mormons claimed that there was an oath of vengeance. The Mormon rebuttal to this was that no oath was administered in the endowment ceremony, but rather a prayer. They do acknowledge the existence of a prayer within the endowment ceremony. Second, some ex-Mormons claimed that Joseph and Hiram their deaths were to be avenged in the endowment oath. And the Mormon response to that was they claimed that Joseph and Hiram were not mentioned in the ceremony, only the prophets were mentioned. Third, some ex-Mormons have claimed that the Mormons were to do the avenging. The Mormons claimed that a prayer was offered to God to avenge. And fourth, some ex-Mormons claim that the vengeance was to be upon this nation or government, and the Mormons claim that the nation or government is never mentioned in the endowment ceremony. So then we have these four questions to keep in mind as we look at some of the testimony. Was it an oath or a prayer? What was to be avenged? Who was to be avenged? And on whom? Testimonies concerning the endowment fall into three general categories: those which pertain to Nauvoo up to 1846, those which pertain to the endowment house in Salt Lake City from 1855 to 1889, and those which pertain to the Salt Lake Temple and other temples from 1893 to the present. Concerning the Nauvoo Temple, in 1846, two brief exposés of the endowment appeared in the Warsaw Signal, but neither mentioned any oath of vengeance. The first detailed account of the endowment in the Nauvoo Temple was that of Increase McGee Van Dusen in 1847, which was reprinted at least eight times. In his first edition, he gave this description: "We are required to kneel to this altar, where we have an oath administered to the effect that we will from this time henceforth and forever use our influence to murder this nation and teach it to our posterity and all that we have influence over in return for their killing the prophet Joseph. They say the murdering of Smith is a national offense. It is true that all was not personally engaged in the act, but the nation has long winked at the abuse of the Mormons, and in this way they have encouraged mobs from time to time until they have finally taken the life of the Lord's prophet. And now it is the will of the Lord that the nation should be destroyed, and this is his will, that we shall enter into this secret conspiracy against the government." In subsequent editions, he presented this as the wording of the oath: "You do solemnly swear in the presence of Almighty God, His angels, and these witnesses," pointing to individuals in the room who have secret instructions to take life, "that you will from this time henceforth and forever begin to carry out hostilities against this nation and teach it to your children, and to keep the same intent a profound secret now and forever, so help you God." In 1848, Catherine Lewis, who claimed personal experience, recalled that they were instructed to, quote, "Avenge the blood of your brethren every way possible and strive to build up the kingdom. If you do not, you must suffer the penalties before mentioned." In October of 1849, Isaac Sheen and William Smith, who had been apostle and church patriarch before his excommunication, wrote, "We have obtained numerous disclosures concerning the treasonable, blasphemous, licentious, and heaven-daring wickedness of Brigham Young, Orson Hyde, and Company, which they were guilty perpetrators of in the Temple of God at Nauvoo." They then quote the oath from Van Dusen's statement. 2 months later, they incorporated into a remonstrance against the efforts made by Salt Lake Mormons to gain entrance into the Union as the State of Deseret. They presented the oath to the U.S. House of Representatives, claiming, quote, "that the rulers of the Salt Lake Church are bitter and inveterate enemies to our government. They entertain treasonable designs against the liberties of American freeborn sons and daughters of freedom." Brigham Young had previously sent Dr. John M. Bernheisel to Washington as a representative. He vigorously denied the charge. He was familiar with the endowment, having been through the ceremony in the Nauvoo Temple. A letter of his activities sent to Salt Lake City reported that, quote, "the wholesale calumny contained in Smith and Sheen's memorial created quite a sensation in both wings of the Capitol." Since this was a private communication, there seems to be no reason to doubt that Bernheisel truly believes Smith and Sheen's claim regarding the oath was false. Apostle Orson Hyde also refuted Smith and Sheen in the Frontier Guardian, February of 1850. He quoted the purported oath, denied its existence, and cited the Mormon battalion as evidence that the Mormons were not sworn to disloyalty to the government or nation. So then the earliest claim was that an oath administered in the Nauvoo Temple required the saints themselves to avenge the blood of Joseph Smith on the nation through active hostility. This was, however, denied on several occasions. There is a much larger body of testimony for the Endowment House ceremonies, 1855 to 1889. In 1857, John Hyde published an account of his experience in the Endowment House. His is a very free report with many of his own embellishments. He presented four paragraphs of discourse purportedly from the ceremony, encouraging hostility toward the nation and the government. Except for one account, which draws from his work, Hyde's material is unique. He concludes with this version of the oath of vengeance. Another oath is administered, binding the endowee to revenge the death of Joseph Smith on this generation, to cherish constant enmity toward the United States government, doing all in his power for its overthrow, to baffle its designs, to refuse submission and renounce all allegiance, and to obey the church authorities and no other. This has the same tone of active hostility toward the government or nation as does the earlier account of Van Dusen. However, most accounts of the Endowment House ceremony do not go that far. The alleged hostility is unstated. The most widely circulated account of the Endowment House ceremony was that published in a Salt Lake Tribune expose September 28, 1879, as given by an unnamed woman. It became kind of a standard version. It was reprinted several times during the following 30 years and was also the source behind several other exposés. It presented the oath of vengeance as follows. We were then made to swear to avenge the death of Joseph Smith the martyr, together with that of his brother Hiram, on this American nation, and that we would teach our children and our children's children to do so. On February 12, 1906, the Salt Lake Tribune published an expose of the Salt Lake Temple Endowment, which became the most widely circulated report of the ceremony for many years. It was reprinted and cited a number of times. As published in the Tribune this time, it differed substantially from previous exposés. Note that Joseph and Hiram are not mentioned, and that God is to avenge the prophets, not the participants. It reads as follows. You and each of you covenant and agree that you will pray and never cease to pray Almighty God to avenge the blood of the prophets upon this nation, and that you will teach the same to your children unto the third and fourth generation. The sources cited so far give a sampling of the various testimonies from ex-Mormons during the period from 1847 to 1906 and contain all of the major elements alleged to have been included in the oath. Before examining the LDS rebuttal, I will summarize and expand somewhat upon the ex-Mormon's form of the oath by answering these four questions with citations from a number of their exposés and testimonies. Avenge what? Who avenges? On whom? And how? At this point, I was going to go through the material which you have in this little handout. If you'll look at that without the little insert, you will notice that I have included a listing of statements from a number of different sources from 1847 to 1906. Actually, it goes up to 1931. And I have included information from each one of these in regards to these four significant questions. And rather than go over all of this, I'm going to let you do that yourself, but let me just go over quickly a summary of these several points. First, avenge what? Was it the blood of the prophets generally which was to be avenged, or was it specifically the murder of Joseph and Hiram Smith which was to be avenged? And as you look over the testimony of ex-Mormons on this subject, you will find that there is a difference of opinion a difference, a contradiction within the testimony, some saying that it was the blood of Joseph or the blood of Joseph and Hiram that was to be avenged, others indicating that their names were not mentioned, that it was just the death of the prophets that was to be avenged. Okay, the second question, who avenges? As Senator Knox put the question to Henry Lawrence in the Reed-Smoot hearings, was this vengeance to be executed by the person taking the oath or vow, or were you to implore the Almighty to avenge the blood of the prophets? I think it is quite material. And as you go through the testimony here again, you will see, again, there is a discrepancy in the testimony from ex-Mormons as to whether the participants in the endowment were to carry out the vengeance or whether they were to pray for God to carry out the vengeance. The third question, on whom? The question here is, was the nation or the government specifically identified as the object of the vengeance? Here again, there is a discrepancy in the ex-Mormon testimony, some saying that it was definitely the nation upon whom the vengeance was to be administered, and others that it was the Gentiles who caused the murder or the government of the United States, others saying that the nation or government was not mentioned. And the last question, how was the vengeance to be administered? After the first several exposés, explanations of how the vengeance was to be administered were not stated. Also, in the naturalization hearings and the Reed-Smoot hearings, none of the witnesses testified of any acts of vengeance. And you can look over those, and there are references on the back to the sources. So we can see from these, and you will see this as you look over it more closely, that there is significant agreement and disagreement that can be seen within this collection of citations. The ex-Mormon testimony could be amalgamated so as to produce two very different renderings of this aspect of the endowment. First, by making certain selections, it could be asserted that participants in the ceremony were bound by oath to avenge specifically the deaths of Joseph and Hiram Smith by aggressive hostility against the government and the nation, from the president to the last man, through constant enmity, seeking to tear down, destroy, overthrow, and baffle their designs and intentions. Or, by making other selections, the participants are merely instructed to pray for God to avenge the blood of the prophets. The two points which are common to all accounts are that the endowment ceremony included something about avenging and something about prophets. However, there is a far better assessment of the ex-Mormon testimony than these two extremes. First, from the ex-Mormon testimony, it is inconclusive as to whether the ceremony mentions prophets generally or Joseph and Hiram specifically, with substantial testimony on both sides. Second, it is also inconclusive as to whether the participants were to avenge or whether they were to ask God to avenge. Generally, the earlier accounts place the responsibility upon the participants and the later upon God. Third, the accounts vary as to the object of the vengeance, but include the nation, the government, this generation, the enemies of the Mormons, or those who caused the murder of Joseph and Hiram. However, the purpose for which the accounts and testimony generally were produced was to sustain a charge of treason against the Mormons. And thus, most accounts have the nation or government as the recipients of the vengeance. Fourth, after the first several publications which alleged active hostility was advocated, none claimed that any specifics were given as to how the vengeance was to be administered. Looking now at the LDS rebuttal. I have previously referred to the LDS reluctance to discuss aspects of the endowment ceremony publicly. While there is a large body of LDS literature on almost every point of controversy between Mormons and non-Mormons, apostasy, restoration, revelation, baptism, the Godhead, and numerous others, I have found no LDS pamphlets, chapters, or articles on this controversial topic. I believe there never would have been any comment except for the fact of several extreme situations. I will examine two of these: the naturalization hearings in Salt Lake City in 1889 and the Reed-Smoot hearings in Washington from 1904 to 1906. Both of these involved issues deemed very important to church leaders. Both also focused on claims by anti-Mormons that they would prove by testimony from ex-Mormons that the endowment ceremony contained a traitorous oath. And in both, Mormons and ex-Mormons were called to testify under oath. Under this pressure, some guarded rebuttal was reluctantly given. I will look first at the Reed-Smoot hearings. From 1903 to 1906, there had been much interest in the Salt Lake Temple Endowment Ceremony due to a situation involving Apostle Reed Smoot. On January 20, 1903, he had been elected senator to the U.S. Congress by the Utah State Legislature. Within a week, 18 Utah voters, mostly clergy and businessmen, signed a protest against the seating of Reed Smoot. In January of the following year, the Senate Committee on Privileges and Elections commenced hearing the matter. One of the principal complaints against Smoot was that he had entered into a treasonous oath in the endowment ceremony incompatible with his oath as a senator. In rebuttal to this charge, counsel for Reed Smoot called several Mormon and several ex-Mormon witnesses. The testimony of all LDS witnesses on this point consisted of denials like this of Apostle Francis N. M. Lyman. Quote, I took no oath nor obligation against any person or any country or government or kingdom or anything of that kind. None would reveal or confirm any of the content of the endowment, but would only deny that which they claimed was not a part of the ceremony. Several Mormon witnesses and four ex-Mormon witnesses were specifically asked if they had promised or vowed to importune high heaven to avenge the blood of the prophets upon this nation. They all answered no. Apostle James E. Talmadge further testified that in the endowment there is not, quote, anything about avenging the blood of Joseph Smith, Jr., the prophet. He also read the First Presidency's 1903 Christmas letter in which it was stated, nor is any person belonging to it, the church, required to take an oath, obligation, covenant, or agreement against or to the injury of any government under the sun. Two other ex-Mormons contributed to the LDS rebuttal. Henry Lawrence, who had been a worker in the endowment house and claimed to have officiated hundreds of times, testified emphatically that the nation or the United States or the government of the United States was not mentioned in the ceremony. Hugh M. Dougal testified that he had not been a Mormon for many years and that recently he had been a member of the anti-Mormon party in Utah. He testified that he had gone through the endowment house in 1862, but that previous to going there, I had read a book purported to give an expose of the Mormon endowment ceremony, and among them was an obligation that you took, some obligation of disloyalty or enmity to this government. I was looking out particularly for that particular point. He further testified that while they importuned heaven to avenge the blood of the prophets, that there was nothing in regard to this nation. He also denied that there was anything about Joseph Smith. One other important point brought out through four ex-Mormon witnesses by Smoot's attorney was that Revelation 6, verses 9 and 10 was included in the endowment in reference to avenging the blood of the prophets. The significance of this point is that these verses present a plea to heaven to avenge the blood of the slain martyrs. All responsibility for avenging rests with God, not with man. Those verses read, And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth? Interestingly, some of the best rebuttal to the charge in the Reed Smoot hearings came from ex-Mormons who were less guarded in their statements about the content of the endowment than were the Mormon witnesses. In the very extensive questioning of the various witnesses by Mr. Worthington and Mr. Van Cott, counsel for Reed Smoot, their purpose was to establish that the nation or government was not mentioned, that Joseph Smith was not mentioned, that God was called upon to do the avenging, and that Mormons who had received their endowments had not attempted to avenge anything upon this nation. This last point was raised briefly and then dropped since no attempt had been made to sustain a charge of any active hostility on the part of the Latter-day Saints. Let me turn now to the 1889 naturalization hearings in Salt Lake. The most significant LDS rebuttal to the alleged oath of vengeance is found in material pertaining to some naturalization hearings in Salt Lake City in 1889. The significance lies in the fact that President Wilford Woodruff and Apostle John Henry Smith revealed some of the content of the endowment ceremony. A close political contest was anticipated in Salt Lake City in 1890. In 1889, the Liberal Party, mostly non-Mormons, sought to limit the potential Mormon vote by charging that aliens who were members of the LDS Church should not be granted naturalization. Nine cases were heard November 4th through the 14th through the 30th by Judge Thomas J. Anderson. A major argument of those opposing the naturalization of Mormons was that an oath administered in the Endowment House was, quote, incompatible with the oath that they were required to take when becoming citizens. Eight ex-Mormon witnesses testified, which testimony is found in your handout. The thrust of their testimony was that they had been presented with an oath in which they were sworn to avenge the blood of Joseph and Hiram upon the government or nation.
This is the end of side one.
They might be strong to avenge the death of the prophets. Included were the testimonies of an ex-bishop, an ex-endowment house worker, Henry Lawrence, who also testified in the Reed Smoot hearings. His testimony was the most significant for the opposition. 12 witnesses testified for the defense, including 2 ex-Mormons, 1 apostle, and 3 endowment house workers. The nature of their testimony was that no oath of vengeance was administered. The names of Joseph and Hiram Smith were not mentioned, nor was the United States mentioned. Several testified that their right arm had not been anointed for strength to avenge the blood of the prophets, while one remembered such an anointing. The most significant testimony for the defense was that of Apostle John Henry Smith. I quote from a synopsis of his testimony as it appeared in the Daily Tribune, and this is in your handout. Apostle John Henry Smith. I am acquainted with the formula of the Endowment House. I received my endowments years ago and officiated in the House years past. In the course of the administration of the covenants, there is no oath or covenant. No oath or covenant is administered requiring the person to avenge the blood of the prophets on this government. I absolutely declare that I never administered an oath or covenant susceptible of such a construction, and that had any man ever offered such an oath to me, I would have repudiated him on the spot. I have listened for the past 2 days and have racked my brain to find something in the ceremony that could be construed as requiring the blood of the prophets to be avenged. And the only thing I can think of is a passage of Scripture from the 6th chapter of Revelations that is read in the course of a lecture, and it is only in the form of a lecture when the people are advised to pray that the Lord will avenge the blood of the prophets. The names of Joseph and Hiram were never mentioned in my hearing. This prayer that the blood of the prophets in all generations might be avenged was to be taught to all the people. There is no ceremony of any kind by which the arm of a man is to be anointed to be made strong to avenge the death of the prophets. Toward the conclusion of the hearings, President Woodruff returned to Salt Lake City from a trip and responded to some questions by an Associated Press reporter, which appeared in the Deseret Weekly December 7, 1889. Following is one of the questions and answers from that interview. Reporter: One of the aims of the proceedings now going on in court is to prove that there is something antagonistic to the government in the Mormon endowments. What about that charge? President Woodruff: I have already said that there is nothing of that kind in any part or phase of Mormonism. I ought to know about that, as I am one of the oldest members of the church. A good deal is being made of a form of a prayer based upon 2 verses in the 6th chapter of the Revelations of St. John, as contained in the New Testament. It relates to praying that God might avenge the blood of the prophets. An attempt has, I see, been made to connect this with avenging the death of Joseph and Hiram Smith, and to have reference to this nation. It can have no such application, as the endowments were given long before the death of Joseph and Hiram Smith, and have not been changed. This nation or government has never been charged by the Mormon people with the assassination of Joseph and Hiram Smith. As it is well known, the murder was the act of a local mob disguised. Persuasive support for the veracity of these 2 statements by Apostle Smith and President Woodruff is found in 2 private diaries. On November 9th, Apostle Abraham H. Cannon recorded in his private diary, quote, "In questioning of Mormon applicants for citizenship today before Judge Anderson, the oaths of the Endowment House were brought in, and it was stated by liberals that Mormons took vows inimical to the government in that house. Witnesses will be summoned to try to prove this false statement." Several private meetings of church authorities were held to decide what rebuttal should be given in court and by whom. L. John Nuttall attended these meetings and made several significant entries in his personal diary. At that time, he was serving as a private secretary to President Woodruff, and he also had served as a scribe in 1877 at the St. George Temple for the first writing of the endowment ceremony. In his November 12 entry, he referred to, quote, the supposed oaths made in the Endowment House and recorded that at a meeting involving six of the apostles and several others, quote, it was deemed proper for some of our brethren to be present in court on Thursday, whether they are subpoenaed or not by our enemies, and give testimony that no such oath is required of any Latter-day Saints against the government of the United States in the Endowment House or elsewhere. This is an opportune time for the Church to declare itself against these foul untruths so often repeated. This entry seems conclusive that at least six of the leading authorities did not believe the endowment ceremony included the alleged oath of vengeance. On November 13, another meeting of seven apostles and a number of others was held. According to Cannon's diary, several witnesses were selected to, quote, disprove this assertion that Mormons take oaths against the government when they pass through the Endowment House. Those who were selected to be witnesses received some instruction in regard to their testimony, no advice being given, however, for them to deceive or tell any untruths, unquote. Nuttall recorded some conversation at a meeting of several apostles and others on November 14. Quote, the question of testifying to any of the endowments or instructions was considered. Some thought that the instructions given about praying to the Lord to avenge the blood of the prophets and referring to the sixth chapter of Revelations of John, 9th and 10th verses, so as to refute the testimony which has been given today, would be proper. Others thought it should not be mentioned as fully. President Lorenzo Snow was of the opinion that brothers Merrill and Lund and Thatcher could go on to the stand and testify that there were no such oaths, obligations, or covenants required in the endowments. But if they should be asked what did transpire there, they could refuse to answer. Brother John Henry Smith asked if there would be any objection to his referring to what is written in the Revelations of St. John in regard to prayer, etc., by way of rebuttal. Brother Snow answered no, that it would be proper for him to do so, and that brothers Merrill and Lund would corroborate that, but that none of the brethren should give any of the endowments or instructions, but refuse to answer questions to that end. Of the LDS testimony presented at the hearings, Cannon wrote, our side in the endowment oath case today impeached the testimony of some of the witnesses for the prosecution. Even E.L.T. Harrison and other outsiders testified that no oath is ever taken by Mormons against the government. Harrison was a prominent ex-Mormon in Salt Lake City. He testified that, quote, there was no covenant to avenge the blood of prophets against the government. The government or the United States was not referred to. There was nothing that could be construed into a teaching that a man not teaching a man not to be a good citizen. In the Endowment House, I heard a reference to avenging the blood of the prophets and voted on it. No persons were mentioned as prophets, nor was the government or the people of the government referred to. So little explanation was made of the avenging, and so little attention was attached to it, that I did not give special heed to it. I did not understand that I was to do any avenging. The names of Joseph and Hiram Smith were not mentioned in the Endowment House, but I understood that they were included among the prophets. Nuttall recorded in his diary for November 18 that three witnesses who had received their endowments from Joseph Smith at Nauvoo would be available to testify that the endowments as given by the prophet Joseph were the same as given today. They were Joseph Noble, Mercy Thompson, and Bathsheba Smith. Only Bathsheba Smith testified. She stated, in the course of the ceremonies, there is no reference to avenging the blood of the prophets except to pray to the Lord and quote verses in the Bible in the book of Revelation. It is just the same now as before Joseph Smith's death. The significance of this point is that before Joseph Smith's death, the prayer to avenge the blood of the prophets could not have had any specific reference to Joseph and Hiram or to the nation. This would suggest a prayer rather than an oath, and that God was to do the avenging, not the saints. At the outset of the hearings, the opposition claimed that they would prove the endowment ceremony included an oath against the nation. In the hearings, they produced witnesses who testified to that effect. However, their most credible witness, Henry Lawrence, upon cross-examination, testified that the nation or government or United States is not used in the ceremony. That combined with Harrison's testimony and the strength of the testimonies of the LDS witnesses, surprisingly led R.N. Baskin, counsel for the opposition, to concede in his summation that, quote, the government may not be mentioned in the endowment ceremonies, but it is meant. The testimony in the hearings and the diary accounts cited combined together to argue persuasively that those most familiar with the endowment ceremony were certain that no oath of vengeance was administered, that Joseph and Hiram were not mentioned, nor was the nation or government mentioned. What did occur is that Revelation 6, 9 through 10 was cited, and participants were instructed to pray to God to avenge the blood of the prophets. This is in perfect harmony with the efforts made by counsel for Reed Smoot in those hearings 15 years later. I will comment on two final points. The passage from Revelation 6, 9, and 10, brought up a dozen times in the Smoot hearings and the 1889 hearings from both Mormon and ex-Mormon witnesses, was claimed to have been the basis for a prayer for God to avenge the blood of the prophets in the original endowment initiated by Joseph Smith. Circumstantial support for this claim is found in material prior to and immediately following Joseph Smith's death. The concept that God has and will avenge the blood of the prophets and the saints, which is crying from the ground, is found six times in the Book of Mormon. Two of these even prophesy that at the time the Book of Mormon would come forth, the blood of the saints would cry from the ground, 2 Nephi 28:10, and that the time would soon come when God would not suffer cries any longer, Mormon 8:41. This is also found in an 1831 revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 63. An 1842 editorial in the Times and Seasons, attributed to Joseph Smith, lists many of the persecutions of the saints, ancient and modern, and then cites Revelation 6, 9, and 10, indicating that it would be but a little season until God would avenge the blood of the martyrs. So then the concept of the blood of the saints crying out and God avenging was in the mind of Joseph Smith prior to his initiation of the endowment. Immediately following his death, a prominent theme in more than a dozen articles spanning just several months was to let God avenge the blood of the prophets. The Revelation passage was frequently cited in this context, and this is found in a number of references in the Times and Seasons. For years, this same sentiment was expressed in almost every article discussing the martyrdom. The most widely circulated sample of this sentiment is that in DNC section 135, verse 7, which reads, "They were innocent of any crime, and they had often been proved before, and were only confined in jail by the conspiracy of traitors and wicked men. And their innocent blood on the floor of the Carthage jail is a broad seal affixed to Mormonism that cannot be rejected by any court on earth. And their innocent blood on the escutcheon of the state of Illinois, with the broken faith of the state as pledged by the governor, as a witness to the truth of the everlasting gospel that all the world cannot impeach, and their innocent blood on the banner of liberty and on the Magna Carta of the United States is an ambassador for the religion of Jesus Christ that will touch the hearts of honest men among all nations. And their innocent blood, with the innocent blood of all the martyrs under the altar that John saw, will cry unto the Lord of hosts until he avenges that blood on the earth." This all suggests a prevalent sentiment to pray to God to avenge the death of the prophets, which in that setting following the martyrdom certainly meant to the Latter-day Saints Joseph and Hiram Smith. This, however, was an intellectual sentiment, that is, to let God do the avenging, which for many Mormons undoubtedly conflicted with their emotional sentiment to avenge the blood of their beloved prophets personally upon their assassins. In relation to this point, I will cite two diary entries. The first is from the diary of Abraham H. Cannon, previously cited. On December 6, 1889, during discussions of the testimony on the alleged oath of vengeance, he recorded a comment of his father, George Q. Cannon. He said that he understood when he had his endowments in Nauvoo that he took an oath against the murderers of the prophet Joseph as well as other prophets, and if he had ever met any of those who had taken a hand in that massacre, he would undoubtedly have attempted to avenge the blood of the martyrs. In addition to this, on December 21st, 1845, Heber C. Kimball recorded in his diary, The 12 would have to leave shortly, for a charge of treason would be brought against them for swearing us to avenge the blood of the anointed ones, and someone would reveal it, and we should have to part someday between sundown and dark. I have covenanted and will never rest, nor my posterity after me, until those men who killed Joseph and Hiram have been wiped out of the earth. The best evidence supports a view that the predominant sentiment of the Latter-day Saints from the beginning, as well as the wording of the endowment from the beginning, was to pray to God to avenge the persecutions of the saints. This is further confirmed by their peaceful actions. However, these two accounts indicate that in the intense emotion of the aftermath of the martyrdom, that temporarily there was an interpretation imposed upon the endowment ceremony, or some wording added to the effect of an oath or covenant to avenge the death of Joseph and Hiram upon those men who killed them. In conclusion, Mormon leaders who were involved in the writing and administration of the endowment genuinely did not believe that an oath was given, nor did they believe that Joseph and Hiram were mentioned, nor did they believe that the nation or government was mentioned. They did, however, acknowledge a prayer for God to avenge the blood of the prophets. They, of course, were in the best position to have accurate beliefs on the subject. Also, each of these points can be supported by substantial ex-Mormon testimony. Since it seems certain from all sides that some oaths or covenants were given in the endowment and something was said about avenging prophets, it is not difficult to believe that once the suggestion was made of an oath to avenge the blood of Joseph and Hiram upon the nation, that some ex-Mormons would recall such an oath. With the one exception that I cited, in spite of the fact that knowledgeable Mormons have strenuously endeavored to avoid discussion of the endowment ceremony, there is enough available evidence to refute impressively the claim of the existence of an oath of vengeance against the nation for the murder of Joseph and Hiram in the endowment ceremony. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by congratulating Van on his very thoughtful and well-organized analysis of the issue of his paper, which was the existence of a specific oath administered in the temple which required initiates to avenge the death of the prophets on this nation. I'm inclined to agree with Mr. Hale's conclusion to the very narrow question. He concluded the body of evidence impressively refutes the claim of the existence of an oath of vengeance against the nation for the murder of Joseph and Hiram. Rather than dealing in semantics and engaging in a debate as to actual wording in the temple ceremony, my comments are focused on what I see as a preponderance of evidence that the feeling, intent, and disposition of the leadership of the church following Joseph's death for more than 50 years was one of hostility and suspicion toward the government, and a strong belief that God would avenge the death of the prophets by the consumption decreed, which would make a full end of all nations, including and particularly this one. In January 1880, in response to apparently fervent and repeated petitions, Wilford Woodruff received a several-page revelation dealing with retribution upon the nation. Elder Woodruff wrote the revelation and submitted it to the First Presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve, who formally accepted it as the mind and will of the Lord. President Taylor asked Elder Woodruff to submit a prayer for his approval, which was given during the implementation of the revelation, which had Woodruff's words, quote, "The apostles and elders go into our holy places and temples and wash our feet and bear testimony to God and heavenly hosts against the wickedness of this nation." This sentiment persisted in 1887 when Wilford Woodruff prayed in the dedicatory prayer at St. George Temple that, quote, "Now Brigham Young may stand in the flesh to behold the nation broken in pieces like a potter's vessel and swept off the face of the earth as were the Jaredites and Nephites, that the land of Zion may cease to groan under the wickedness and abominations of those who now cumber the ground." wife of stake president Isaac Haight, a man later excommunicated for his role in the Mountain Meadows massacre, is recorded as instructing Relief Society sisters in 1857 to teach their sons and daughters the principles of righteousness and to implant a desire in their hearts to avenge the blood of the prophets. That Brigham Young, at least initially, felt that Mountain Meadows massacre was just such a retribution was inferred by Wilford Woodruff in 1861 when he recorded, while on a trip to the massacre monument with Brigham Young, that, quote, a wooden cross was placed on top of the pile of stone with the following words, vengeance is mine and I will repay, saith the Lord. President Young said it should be, vengeance is mine and I have taken a little. Suffice it to say that, as Mr. Hale has acknowledged, the prevailing official sentiment was one of hostility toward the nation as an effigy for these known and unknown persecutors of the saints and prophets. The concept of retribution was founded in ancient scripture and reinforced in Joseph Smith's day. In section 24 of the DNC, the Lord revealed that whosoever shall lay their hands on you by violence, ye shall command to be smitten in my name, and behold, I will smite them according to your words. Joseph believed that the Lord would do just that, as he confided to a meeting of the anointed quorum, I have been afraid to ask God to kill my enemies, lest some of them should repent. I asked for the Lord to deliver me out of the hands of the governor of Missouri, and the next news that came was that Governor Reynolds had shot himself. And I would now say, beware, O earth, how you fight against the saints of God and shed innocent blood. For in the days of Elijah, his enemies came upon him, and fire was called down from heaven and destroyed them. In his final discourse to the Nauvoo Legion, Joseph excited the crowd by drawing his sword and making an oath before God that, quote, I have drawn my sword, and it shall never be sheathed again until vengeance is taken on all our enemies. The issue at hand is whether these sentiments were ever formalized into ceremony, which required temple initiates to enter into such oaths. As Van has related, George F. Richards issued directives in 1927 to the temple presidents that they, quote, omit from the ordinance and lecture all reference to retribution, and omit from the prayer in the circles all reference to avenging the blood of the prophets. Portions of the temple ceremony have never been reduced to writing and were given as instructions by the officiator, leading, in my opinion, to the possibility and even probability that there were variations of wording between temples and officiators in these unwritten instructions. William Thomas and John P. Holmgren testified during the Smoot hearings that they remembered having been anointed during the initiatory ordinances that, quote, your arm will be strong in avenging the blood of the prophets, suggesting an active personal part in such retribution. The very existence of such a wide variance of experience represented in the conflicting testimony given by enemies of the church convinces me that these testimonies were not part of a well-orchestrated plan to indict the church, but more indicative that due to the extemporaneous nature of this area of the endowment, these people actually had differences in administration. It is clear that the sentiment existed and that a sufficient doctrinal foundation existed to have these things taught in the temple and elsewhere. The direct rebuttal to the existence of these oaths by the church leadership is stated almost as emphatically as the repeated denials of continuing plural marriages which were being performed and entered into by these same leaders. The purported purpose of the two hearings cited by Mr. Hale was to determine eligibility for a temple-initiated Mormon to be a U.S. senator or even a citizen of the United States. Although conflicting testimony regarding the precise wording of the endowment ceremony make an absolute determination difficult, the underlying issue of allegiance to the nation by men and women harboring such hostilities seems to be of more significance than the existence of a treasonous oath. The senators would no doubt have been equally concerned had testimony revealed the 1880 revelation of Wilford Woodruff and the subsequent cursing of the nation by the highest authorities of the church. Very little has been discussed publicly about these issues, and probably for good reason. Those who have made covenants not to reveal should not reveal. If there is any freedom at all from that obligation in this discussion, it is because those oaths are not in our personal experience. Mr. Hale's paper goes a long way toward making a case against an official oath of vengeance, but necessarily leaves some important ground uncovered. A favorite Calvin Grandall cartoon has a young missionary sitting in front of his mission president explaining about his companion. First I thought, what would Jesus do, and I forgave him. Then I thought, what would Porter Rockwell do, and I slugged him. I, for one, would like to see Van on the program next year expanding his topic to discuss the concept of vengeance and retribution in general and the place they should or should not have in a Christian religion. Thank you.
Looks like we have about 3 or 4 minutes if any of you would like to ask questions. Let me just say, in closing, that the next session in this room will be Sticks and Stones and Alvin's Bones, a discussion of Michael Quinn's early Mormonism and the Black Magic View. That will start at 9:45. We certainly would like to thank both Van and Jeffrey for the great job that they did. If any of you have any questions, I'll let them you could just ask them and I'll have them respond.
That was a subject that I had intended to deal with in my paper until I realized it was already too long. But there was substantial testimony given by a number of both Mormons and ex-Mormons that there had not been any change in the endowment ceremony. I have about 8 or 9 different statements of testimony to that effect. Also, to argue that there, I mean, obviously, not having on record every time the endowment ceremony was presented makes it impossible for us to state conclusively on that. But the argument that has been advanced by a number of those in the 1920s and 30s in anti-Mormon literature was that the endowment ceremony had been changed, that originally it was to avenge the blood of Joseph and Hiram upon this nation, and later Joseph and Hiram were deleted from it, and so forth. But what I think you can see from all the testimony is that you go back to the 1889 period when there is a testimony regarding the endowment house, you have testimony being given both ways. And during the Reed Smoot hearings, you have the same situation. So what you could do is you could, from the testimony, argue either kind of evolution, either that it evolved to an oath that involved the Joseph and Hiram and the nation, or that it evolved away from that. I just simply think from the conflicting testimony given, there is not any reason to conclude, as far as I can see, that the ceremony had undergone some change, and there is some substantial reason to doubt that it had based upon the testimony of both Mormon and ex-Mormon witnesses.
Those of you that may like to stick around for a few minutes and ask some personal questions, feel free to do so. We do need to reconvene here in about 12 more minutes, so thank you very much.
This is the end of this cassette.